and you're listening to CFRC 101.9.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Sue.
And I'm Carrie.
And you're listening to CFRC 101.9 in Kingston, Ontario.
We're the good lovelies.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This year marks 20 years since the launch of the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, otherwise known as BDS, a global call for justice, freedom, and equality for Palestinians. In this special episode, we sit down with Omar Barghouti, co-founder of BDS, to reflect on two decades of grassroots resistance, the movement's growing global impact, and why BDS is more vital now than ever in the face of escalating repression and genocide in Gaza. This is a conversation about power, solidarity, and the enduring fight for liberation. Thank you for listening. This is the MondoWise Podcast.
Okay, so to start, I wanted to maybe talk about, as we reflect on the 20th anniversary of BDS, for those who maybe don't know, I was wondering if you could talk, we could backtrack a little and talk about the history. Can you talk about kind of the groups that came together, people that came together 20 years ago to create it, and particularly interested in if you could also speak about what the goals and intentions of the movement were from the beginning, because that's obviously an issue that's often misconstrued, especially here in U.S. media, the way the movement is construed in terms of what it's aiming for and what its goals are. So can you just take us back? Can we just start right at the beginning in terms of who started it and what the idea was?
Sure. It's important to situate it, though, in the current genocide, ongoing live stream genocide by Israel in Gaza, because BDS is now even that much more important than it has ever been because of the genocide, because of the role BDS has played for the last 20 years in fighting the complicity of states, corporations, and institutions that have enabled Israel to continue its settler colonialism, its apartheid, its military occupation, leading up to this genocide. So going back to 2005, when BDS was established, Many civil society groups, trade unions, coalitions of political parties, women's unions, students, academics, and so on, professional unions, grassroots movements, got together and signed the BDS call, which a number of us drafted, basically, after consulting over months, almost a year of consultations, community consultations. And what I mean by that, consultations within historic Palestine in the 67 territory or the 48 territory, Palestinians in exile, in refugee camps, in the Western exile, and so on. Because we wanted this call to be inclusive of all Palestinians, especially after so many years of the so-called Oslo Accords and the complete fragmentation, if not complete undermining of the struggle for Palestinian rights. But the fragmentation was the most important. So BDS was inspired mainly by a century of Palestinian popular resistance, initially against British colonialism and then Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. So we've learned the tactics of BDS mainly from our own people's struggle. but it's also inspired by many liberation movements, especially the South African anti-apartheid movement, and of course, justice movements like the civil rights movement in the United States. Those played a very important role in inspiring the philosophy, if you will, of the BDS movement. So we decided that at a minimum, in order for Palestinians to exercise our inalienable right as an indigenous people in our homeland to self-determination, three rights must be achieved: an end to the military occupation, an end to the system of racial domination, segregation, and apartheid, and the right of refugees to return and receive reparations. Without those three rights, we cannot exercise self-determination. We cannot enjoy the full menu of rights, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu would say. Now, why address all three? Because Palestinians have been fragmented by this different phases of Zionist settler colonialism into three main constituent parts. Palestinians in the occupied Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, as recognized by the UN, constitute only 38% of the entire Palestinian people. This is something, since the Oslo Accords of 1993, people have forgotten, that the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are really a minority. 12% of the Palestinian people are citizens of present-day Israel, living under a system of apartheid as second- or third-class citizens. And then 50% of Palestinians are in exile, not allowed to go home, not allowed to enjoy the right of return, as stipulated in international law. Within Palestinian communities in historic Palestine, whether 67 or 48, there's a very large minority of internal refugees, internally displaced persons, who together with the 50% in exile constitute the absolute majority of Palestinians. And that's why the right of return is the most important right that the BDS movement has called for. Another important aspect about BDS is that it's an inclusive movement that has a unified leadership. The absolute largest coalition in Palestinian society, the BDS National Committee, or BNC, leads this global movement. This coalition includes all the largest coalitions that have ever existed in Palestine are part of it, including Palestinians in exile. BDS is opposed to racism of all forms, and therefore it opposes anti-Palestinian racism, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish, anti-Black, anti-Indigenous racism, and so on, as it opposes sexism and misogyny and all kinds of discriminatory tendencies. And it is based on international law, but it has a critical view of international law. We understand exactly the limitations of international law, and we work to expand the interpretation of it. And we've done that quite successfully, and I can give some examples.
Yeah, that'd be great. That was actually my next question. I was going to ask you kind of milestones over the last 20 years. So that'd be a great segue if you wanted to talk about some of those examples.
Sure. There are too many to mention, but we're putting out a statement tomorrow about 20 years of BDS, or BDS at 20 highlights of this long two decades. But in the midst of genocide, we feel it is quite inappropriate, quite awkward, quite tone deaf to celebrate. So we're not celebrating, but we're marking the occasion, highlighting the impact, the immense impact this movement, this grassroots-based movement with its so many partners around the world has achieved in 20 years, not against Israel only, a nuclear power with immense influence in the colonial West, but against the entire colonial West. Israel settler colonialism is not just Israeli, it's a Western project. So throughout those 20 years, we were up against the U.S. government, both Congress and White House, European bureaucracy, the European Union, the UK, and so on, and every single one of those countries, Australia and Canada, and so on. So it wasn't just a struggle against Israel's repression and Israel's attempts to fight BDS. It was against all of the partners in crime of Israel, if you will, the colonial West. But to highlight the most important aspects, BDS has actually reshaped what solidarity with Palestinian liberation means and should look like. What I mean by that, as I said, BDS is very influenced by the South African anti-apartheid struggle and the U.S. civil rights movement, but it has created its own philosophical underpinnings, understanding of what solidarity should look like. Our analysis was Palestinians cannot alone reach liberation, freedom, justice, equality without cutting the links of international complicity with Israel's regime of settler colonialism, apartheid, military occupation, and now genocide, because Israel relies extremely on this support it gets, diplomatic, financial, military, academic, cultural, in sports, and so on and so forth, that it gets mainly from the colonial West. So BDS said the first very profound obligation, if you want to do real solidarity, is to do no harm and to stop or cut back or offset, if you cannot do either, the harm done in your name. So if you're a citizen of the United States and you know that your government is deeply implicated in all Israeli crimes against the Palestinians, including the ongoing genocide, in all aspects of this genocide, it's a U.S.-Israeli genocide. That's how Palestinians look at it. What does this say about the responsibility of someone in the U.S.? That means that anyone in the U.S. should offset that, should compensate for the government speaking on their behalf is implicated in such crimes by joining BDS, by supporting ending complicity in their unions, in their schools, in their universities, in their hospital, in whatever area they work in. So that concept is a very important achievement for the BDS movement, actually, in those 20 years. A second aspect at this macro level, if you will, is the analysis of Israel's regime as one of settler colonialism and apartheid. We did not invent that. Of course, historians have written about that, but it's been forgotten throughout the Oslo Accords years. The Palestinian question was reduced to the occupied West Bank and Gaza, and some form of autonomy and so on, as if it's a dispute between Israel and its neighbors. The BDS movement said, no, this is about settler colonialism and apartheid that has existed since the very foundation, the very establishment of the settler colony, Israel, as a Jewish supremacist state on the ruins of the Palestinian indigenous homeland. That's what it is. And therefore, without this right analysis, we cannot find the right tools to dismantle the system of oppression. Many years later, major human rights organizations, UN experts, and so on started recognizing Israel as an apartheid state. Some of them started talking about settler colonialism, but we have a long way. But that is one of the main impacts, if you will, of the BDS movement. But also, of course, there are many impacts at the S level, the sanctions or meeting obligations under international law, at the D level, divestment, and at the B level, the boycott. I'll start with the policy level, or what we call the S in BDS, which is mainly about observing, meeting, honoring obligations under international law, not discretionary sanctions, and definitely not the criminal sanctions that the U.S. has applied against Cuba and Venezuela and Iran and Iraq in the past and half the global South. So what in that field, before the genocide, before October 23, we had no countries supporting a military embargo of Israel. Now there are 52 states that have an official policy of a military embargo. There are loopholes, yes, but at least they've adopted that policy. Many states have taken actual actions as measures of accountability. Colombia, for example, has banned the import of Israeli weapons and is working to ban the export of coal to Israel because of its genocide. Turkey has played a role in cutting a lot of trade with Israel. Malaysia has prevented ships going to Israel, and so on and so forth. This is very new. We haven't had many states doing things. And the Norwegian Pension Fund, which is a sovereign state fund, the biggest in the world, has divested from Israel bonds and several companies involved in apartheid. That's at the policy level in a nutshell. Many states have prevented ships carrying military materiel to Israel from using their ports. Malta, Angola, South Africa, and others. Dock workers played a very important role in this achievement. At the D level, the divestment, we've seen major pension funds divest. I mentioned state funds. In addition to Norway, there's New Zealand and Netherlands and Luxembourg, among others, but also among faith communities. The United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, among others, have divested from either Israeli banks or U.S. companies or French companies involved in Israel's occupation and human rights violations. Now we're seeing universities across the United States divesting thanks to the student-led mobilizations and encampments and the faculty supporting them that have led to several divestments across the U.S. and also in Europe. At the B level, which is the grassroots boycott level, many people understand BDS as only targeting corporations and consumer goods. That is definitely a very important part of BDS, but there's also academic boycott, cultural boycott, sports boycott. I mentioned military embargo to start with because that's a sanction. But as far as boycotts are concerned, all of these are important. Across Europe, for example, we're seeing many universities for the first time ever cutting ties with Israeli universities, even refusing to work with Israeli universities within the so-called Horizon program, the largest research program of the European Union. We're seeing faculties, departments cut ties, but also whole universities. In the cultural sphere, we're seeing cultural centers cut ties, divesting or installing procurement policies that exclude companies involved in Israel's occupation and apartheid. And we're seeing thousands and thousands of artists and writers and publishers joining the cultural boycott of Israel, which, like the academic boycott, is institutional. It targets complicity, not identity. It targets institutions, not individuals. And this is very important difference between the BDS movement and the South African boycott, which was a blanket boycott against everyone and everything South African. And of course, against corporations, we're seeing some of the largest corporations in the world have been compelled, thanks to BDS pressure, to abandon entirely their illegal projects in the Israeli economy. Some of them are Veolia, CRH, Orange, Puma, among others. There's G4S, the largest security company in the world, and so on. So there's so many companies that have been forced because of losing tenders across the world because of BDS pressure. And some companies like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, campaigns that started at the grassroots level, we call them organic campaigns, that the BDS movement has adopted and supported. Since we've adopted those campaigns, they have really begun to influence those companies' bottom line. The CEO of McDonald's has repeatedly said that they're losing markets in many parts of the world. Some Israeli financial media puts the losses at McDonald's at about $6 billion in revenues because of boycott pressures. Coca-Cola is facing a similar fate. Companies like Chevron, the large oil company, is beginning to feel the heat. Intel was forced to abandon a $25 billion project in Israel that they planned 2 months into the genocide. BDS played a role, not the only role, but an important role in this campaign. And I can go on and on. There's so many examples of impact. And as I said, it's very important to mark this. We cannot celebrate. We're too angry. We're too enraged. We're too sad to celebrate. Yet we need to mark this because this is part of building hope and building people power to affect policy change.
I'm wondering, reflecting back on the early days of BDS and kind of everything that's happened over the past two decades, when you look back, open-ended question, but I'm wondering what you've learned or what potentially surprised you. Particularly, I'm interested kind of, you know, we've seen these here in the U.S., really strident laws attacking BDS. Did the backlash surprise you? Is there anything that you've learned through the process? Has it recalibrated kind of the way that you approach campaigns? Just any reflections on that level, I'd be interested in.
About the U.S. Specifically?
Yeah, specifically.
Sure. Yeah, we've always known that U.S. Partnership with Israel is the most important, that without the U.S. military, financial, economic, diplomatic support for apartheid, it cannot continue. But when we began the BDS movement 20 years ago, we had no idea how much influence Israel has in the U.S. government, Congress, and the White House. We had no idea it was to that extent. We've always known and read the analyses about the Israel lobbies, not one lobby, the Jewish Zionist lobby, the Christian Zionist lobby, the military industrial complex lobby, and so on and so forth. Now we have the tech lobby that is invested heavily in Israel because they get to test their weaponized AI and weaponized cloud services in the battlefield against Palestinians, so to speak. But we had no idea that the U.S. government would put Israel ahead of almost anything else and would act like Israel's ambassador everywhere in the world. So in any international conference, any resolution on Palestine, the main fight is not with Israel, because Israel is usually too small, too insignificant to count. You're fighting with the U.S. government, with the U.S. administration. In any international forum, be it the United Nations, international scholarly associations, international unions, it's always the United States, number one, and then Germany, and then the rest of the Europeans, Israel's ambassadors. This level of co-optation, corruption, and complete partnership in crime was quite a surprise for us, indeed. We had no idea it was at this level. Another aspect, which I think kind of surprised us, maybe because we were too influenced by the Western propaganda about liberal democracy. We've always known that, we've always looked at it very critically, that it's limited. Those of us who studied in the U.S. have always known the limits of liberal democracy. I mean, after all, a settler colony like the United States that just recognized equal rights for women not too long ago, not to mention equal rights for blacks. Until now, there are no equal rights for indigenous communities in the United States. Jim Crow wasn't that long ago. So we never took this liberal democracy at face value. We've always looked deeper. But we had no idea that the United States, which has always cherished its First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, the freedom of speech and expression and so on, would sacrifice these civil rights to protect, to shield Israel from accountability, from grassroots campaigns. Why would the state of Texas punish survivors of a flood in a town that in the middle of nowhere in Texas, that have gone to the state to ask for support after the floods destroyed all their livelihoods, and they were made to sign an anti-BDS pledge. And they had no idea with what this BDS was, but they had to sign something saying, I will not boycott Israel or territories under Israel's control while receiving aid from the state of Texas. Why? What could have led to such a level of penetration of Israeli interests in states, not to mention federal government, and sacrificing civil rights, sacrificing the U.S. Constitution to shield Israel apartheid from accountability was quite a shock to us. The last point I want to mention that's U.S. specific, when I used to tour the U.S. Intensely, 2015, 2016, I remember in church after church, university after university, community center after community center, I was always saying, those anti-BDS laws that are starting will not stop at BDS or the Palestinians, unless every justice movement looks at this as a threat to all, because it's a threat to the First Amendment. And once they abuse the First Amendment, they bend it to allow for suppressing speech on Palestine, and BDS is freedom of expression, then they would use that against everyone else. Can't you see it? This is a new McCarthyism. Just like the first McCarthyism was not really against the communist Reds only. That's how it started, and then it was against every dissenting voice. This McCarthyism 2.0 will not stop at Palestine or BDS. At that point, very few were listening, including our strongest partners. They did not comprehend that the writing on the wall that Palestinians were seeing first was true. They might have thought that we were being alarmist, exaggerating. It took them years. 2020, 2021, they began to realize that the anti-BDS legislation was used as a template for suppressing black voting rights, women's reproductive rights, campaigners against fossil fuels, and so on and so forth. The exact wording in state legislature after another was used to suppress those other justice movements. So this intersectionality of struggles, which is now much more obvious, much more taken for granted, was not so obvious a few years ago.
I'm wondering, you already referenced this a little, but I'm wondering how October 7th kind of changed, if it changed your project and maybe recalibrated it. And just, I'm wondering if it's, to your mind, has brought more people to this cause inevitably based on, you know, 19 months of an ongoing genocide.
Well, 21 months almost. Since the beginning of the genocide, we, all Palestinians, were in a state of complete shock. I mean, the level of grief, the level of rage have been unprecedented. Nothing has prepared us for a live stream genocide. We've always thought that there must be some limits, some international law mechanism that will kick in and stop a live stream genocide. Even the United States, the world's only empire, has never dared to perpetrate a live stream genocide. Even the United States. It has always tried to find excuses for killing millions in Vietnam, hundreds of thousands in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and across the world. They've always tried to find anti-communist, anti-this, but they've never said those people are human animals and we're going to slaughter them. We're going to cut off water, electricity, and food and let them die. They never said we're going to concentrate them in camps. This is the language used today by the Israeli establishment. They want to concentrate over 2 million Palestinians in camps. What does this sound like? So to get away with this was an absolute shock. However, we could fall into despair, which is exactly what our detractors want. Colonize our minds with utter despair, utter powerlessness. There's nothing that we can do to stop this. Israel, supported by the US and the European Union and the UK, is unstoppable. It will continue killing and killing and killing. There's nothing we can do. That is one path that we refuse to take on ethical grounds. And there was the other path, the difficult one. We're going to channel our immense grief, our boundless rage, into constructive energy, to campaign like never before, to isolate apartheid Israel at every level possible, academic and cultural and sports and economic, and every company involved in Israel's crimes against us. We need to exact a price from it, a reputation price, the bottom line, and so on. And that's the path that we took in the BDS movement from day one, since October 8th, actually. We issued our first statement, we analyzed this as a genocide, and we called for action. We called for escalating pressure, disruption, peaceful disruption of business as usual in every institution, every corporation that are complicit. We called for boycotts like never before, for pressure on governments, and we had the tools, because we had been building this toolbox for many, many, many years. We've built alliances and networks with trade unions and grassroots movements and racial justice movements and indigenous groups across the world. So we were a little prepared with our strategies, but we had to decolonize our mind from the hopelessness. But your other point is absolutely right. Because of the genocide, because of the unspeakable horror that Israel has visited upon us, and the killing and killing and destruction, destroying Gaza's 4,000-year civilization, that has enraged not just Palestinians and many across the Arab region, but many across the world, especially the younger generation. And I think Israel will live or not to regret it, to regret that it has lost entirely the young generation, Gen Z and the younger generation across the world. from Japan to the United States, from South Africa to Sweden, from Latin America to Indonesia, everywhere. They've lost the younger generations completely. By losing them, those young people who are so angry, and I'll explain another intersectional aspect of their anger. It's solidarity with Palestinians. It's rage about what Israel is getting away with and how their leaders are trying to justify this, are trying to sanitize this in such dehumanizing language, like the U.S. President, Biden, U.S. Congress almost entirely, with a few exceptions, European governments, almost all of them, with very few exceptions. They were so colonial, so dehumanizing. The so-called media outlets, from the New York Times genocidal coverage to the BBC super genocidal coverage, not to mention the Fox News, the fascists, and so on. Across the colonial West, the mainstream media played a very important role in inciting to genocide. And when we have the power to have our own Nuremberg, it's not only the presidents and the ministers of defense and the governors and so on who have led the support for the genocide that should be held to account, but also media executives, big tech executives, the executives of all the arms corporations that have sold the weapons and the companies themselves. So we will hold them all to account. And that's a very important point. So I think those young generations were seeing that it's not just to Palestinians. Israel is destroying international law. It's destroying the order that has ever existed. And bringing in a might makes right error with the support of the US and Europe. And this might makes right error is making the world so unsafe, so unpredictable for all of us. On top of the climate disaster, now you have another disaster of a world where the powerful can do whatever they wish. And they can just sanitize it and whitewash it with the right propaganda tools like the New York Times and the BBC. What kind of future will we have as young people? And I've heard this over and over from universities in Indonesia and in Stockholm and in Cape Town. The same sentiment, despite the immense difference, saying the same thing. People are scared of what Israel is doing. President Gustavo Petro of Colombia was the first head of state back in October 23 who said, Gaza is only the first experiment. They will consider us all dispensable unless we do something about it. And he was so right. And this reflects the sentiment among the global majority, actually, not just in the global South. So I think that has channeled a lot of energy into supporting BDS. And you've seen our campaigns grow immensely. We've begun to have influence on policy much more during the genocide. We've begun to exact a heavy price from complicit companies during the genocide. Because the support was extremely large and people wanted something effective to do. Not just sloganeering, not just raising slogans and marching, and that's very important, but it's not enough. You need to cut complicity. It's all about complicity. That's what meaningful solidarity begins with. Do no harm and complicity in your sphere of relative influence.
And my final question, I'm just another open-ended one, but I'm wondering kind of how you envision the future of BDS. What does the next 20 years look like? How do you see this campaign evolving as it gains more momentum as a result of the things that we're talking about? And kind of what are the campaigns that you're most focused on going forward in the coming years?
Well, we hope we won't have a BDS movement in 20 years. We hope that apartheid will be dismantled, occupation will be ended, Palestinian refugees will be able to return and reestablish their lives. So we won't need a BDS movement. The BDS movement was born because states have failed to hold Israel accountable to anything. International law broke down, and now it's being buried under the rubble of Gaza and under the corpses of tens and tens of thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children. If that were not to happen, we wouldn't have had a BDS movement. So we really hope in 20 years we won't have this movement if peace, justice, dignity, self-determination, the right of return prevail. We won't need a BDS movement. But until then, we will continue escalating our pressure. And we're getting more sophisticated. We have many, many more allies, many more partners. Just one example, we just disrupted, our activists disrupted a United Nations conference in Geneva called AI for Good. Extremely provocative title, not to mention that the United Nations is partnering with Microsoft, Google, Amazon, IBM, Cisco, and other companies that are enabling the genocide. What AI for Good? So we've established a very broad coalition calling on the UN to designate AI and cloud as dual use because they have a military application and to regulate them as such, including under the Arms Trade Treaty. This work would have been completely impossible 2 years ago. Now it's possible. Now many form a coalition and work with us on this. So we will continue to do this, partnering with so many trade unions and grassroots movements in their millions, supporting our demands. Today, calling for boycotting Israel, divesting from companies invested in Israel, and supporting its crimes against Palestinians, and even imposing lawful targeted sanctions, the only sanctions we call for, has become not beyond the pale as they were 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. Today, it's much more mainstream. But there's a complete split between the establishment, especially in the colonial West, that is still extremely colonial, extremely genocidal, and extremely supportive of Israel no matter what, and the grassroots, especially the younger people who are all pro-Palestine today. So when they say Palestine frees us all, they really mean it. In the struggle to stand with Palestine, they've discovered the limits of their so-called liberal democracies, their universities that were supposedly democratic. They discovered how repressive, how autocratic, how corporate controlled they are. They've discovered their governments to be mainly oligarchies, not so much democracies, and so on and so forth. They've discovered the corruption in the political class and the economic class and the military-industrial complex. Those discoveries will push younger generations to really demand change and lead change.
Great. Well, that's all I have. Thank you so much for chatting with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's our show. Mondo Weiss is a nonprofit publication with no paywalls. If you would like to support our work, please go to mondoweiss.net/donate. Thanks for listening.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I was in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, on Monday, at the headquarters of the United Nations Human Rights Council. I had the chance to sit down and speak with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, about a number of issues. In today's segment, we're going to look at Israel's attack on Gaza. We spoke soon after Israel issued new forced evacuation orders for Palestinians in areas of northern Gaza. In a statement last month, Volker Türk characterized Israel's actions in Gaza as ethnic cleansing, saying, quote, "This latest barrage of bombs forcing people to move amid the threat of intensified attacks, the methodical destruction of entire neighborhoods, and the denial of humanitarian assistance underline that there appears to be a push for a permanent demographic shift in Gaza that's in defiance of international law and is tantamount to ethnic cleansing," unquote. I ask Volker Türk about his comments.
You must imagine over the last over 20 months or so that the population inside Gaza has been displaced multiple times. I've heard it directly from some of our staff who told me that they had to move from the north to the south, back to the north, and back to the south, and within these areas again and again. So it shows a group of people multiply displaced, and with the latest orders, they are essentially now confined to one-fifth of the territory. So you basically ask people to go again to one-fifth of the territory and empty up the land. That's what prompted me to call it ethnic displacement and ethnic cleansing. Mm.
And just this past weekend, officials in Gaza say at least 81 Palestinians were killed, 400 injured, just over a day period. You have accused Israel of inflicting horrifying, unconscionable suffering on Palestinians. What is your response to the latest developments?
Well, you have seen that they established the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is essentially a militarized form of providing humanitarian assistance. We have seen at least over 600 people killed when they tried to go to these distribution points. We used to have, when the UN was still able to work a little bit more, we were having about 400 distribution points. Now it's limited to 4 or 5, and it's heavily militarized. And as a result, you see people being killed, you see chaos, because the fundamental principles of humanitarian action are not respected. So yes, humanitarian action is extremely important in these circumstances, and it's just not happening at the scale and speed that is required in order to save people's lives.
Can you talk about Israel's attack on UNRWA itself, on the UN agency?
So the fact that UNRWA was vilified in the way that it was actually shows that there is a total misunderstanding of the role of the United Nations. We are here to provide relief. We are here to help people in need. We are here also in humanitarian action to do this type of work. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to do it, and UNRWA was the prime target in all of this, which is very, very unfortunate and has really real-life consequences.
Is it a war crime?
I mean, the UNRWA, there are many things that happen in this war that are clearly war crimes. Collective punishment, issues of denying of humanitarian assistance. It's a very complex legal issue how to deal with UNRWA, and in fact, it's currently before the International Court of Justice.
I mean, the number of healthcare workers that have been killed, the hundreds of journalists who have been killed, those that are there to provide humanitarian aid. I just have to ask, the United Nations some 80 years ago was founded to end war, right, promote fundamental human rights, reaffirm international law. When you watch what is unfolding in Gaza, you might think the UN is totally useless.
Well, the principles are there, and the principles need to be respected. Let's not forget. Why was the United Nations created? The United Nations were created after two world wars, horrific suffering, 60 million people in Europe alone displaced as refugees, the Holocaust, atrocity crimes, massive violations of human rights. There was a sentiment, never again. We are going to establish a world order that respects territorial integrity, independence, that respects human rights and international humanitarian law. And yes, 80 years later, I'm indeed shocked at what I see around the world, because we have the highest number of conflicts and utter disrespect for international law. And that is worrying and should wake us all up, because we don't need a world where anarchy reigns and chaos.
How do you see a ceasefire taking place after Iran, Israel and U.S. bombing Iran? That happened quite quickly, but not in Gaza. The violence is only intensifying.
No, I really hope, my most fervent hope is that there is a permanent ceasefire, that all the remaining hostages are released unconditionally, that indeed humanitarian aid is finally coming in at a scale and a magnitude that is required, and that there will be a political solution, which means a two-state solution. There's no way around that. And yeah, I mean, and we can never give up on any of this, even when at the moment it looks very unrealistic, but one should never ever cast this aside. That's the only solution for both Israelis and Palestinians to live side by side in peace.
That's Volker Türk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. We were speaking at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has arrived in Washington, D.C. for talks with President Trump. It's Netanyahu's third trip to Washington since Trump's inauguration in January. Once again, the U.S. will not enforce an international criminal court warrant seeking Netanyahu's arrest for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Gaza. Ahead of the meeting, Trump predicted there's a good chance Israel and Hamas will reach a deal on a new U.S.-promoted Gaza ceasefire framework, which Trump has called his final final proposal for the Palestinians. Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 24 people so far today, following another bloody weekend that saw scores of Palestinians slaughtered. Among the dead, at least 6 people killed when Israel bombed a medical clinic in Gaza City housing displaced Palestinians. At least 15 others were wounded. Separately, Doctors Without Borders, Medecins Sans Frontières, known as MSF, is condemning the killing of Abdullah Hamad, a former MSF worker shot dead by Israeli forces July 3rd. Colleagues say Hamad was part of a group of Palestinians seeking to collect flour from an aid truck in Khan Yunis when Israeli forces attacked without warning, killing at least 16 people. Dr. Hamad is the 12th member of Doctors Without Borders killed by Israel's military since October 2023. Attacks on health facilities and medical workers in Gaza have been repeated and defining aspect of Israel's assault on Gaza. The World Health Organization reports 94% of hospitals in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed over the past 20 months, despite the fact hospitals are supposed to have protections under international law. In May, the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition reported attacks on healthcare facilities worldwide have become more frequent over the last decade, and in 2024, a quarter of all the attacks on health facilities worldwide occurred in Gaza. Israel almost always justifies attacks on hospitals by accusing Hamas of militarizing these facilities. An incredible 609 healthcare workers in Gaza have been killed. Our next guest has witnessed the consequences of these attacks firsthand. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is a trauma, general, and critical care surgeon who volunteered in March at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, Gaza, with MedGlobal. Last year, he volunteered at the European Hospital during Israel's assault on Gaza. His new piece for the Council on Foreign Relations, Think Global Health, is co-authored with attorney Leonard Rubinstein. It's headlined Hospital Attacks in Gaza and Israel, What Counts as a War Crime? Well, Dr. Feroz Sidwa, what counts as a war crime? Explain what has happened after what, in the latest news, we hear about this healthcare worker, this doctor who has just been killed online for food, and the director of the Indonesian hospital, the leading cardiologist, just killed as well in Gaza.
Yeah, Dr. Sultan, the actually at this point, if I'm correct, I hope I'm right about this, but I'm pretty sure at this point that the director of every hospital north of the Netzarim corridor, so in the northern half of Gaza, has either been killed or is in Israeli detention. The reason Len and I wrote this article is because we hadn't really seen anything that brought together the fact that the attacks on healthcare in Gaza are really a defining feature of the U.S.-Israeli attack on the territory, and it's so widespread as to be really kind of unique in history.
So, talk about the story of your 16-year-old patient Ibrahim. The story you tell in your piece for the Council on Foreign Relations.
Sure. Yeah. On March 18th, that's when the widespread bombing of Gaza resumed since the January 19th ceasefire. And the last operation I did that day was in a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim. He had injuries to his colon and rectum. I operated on him, stopped him from dying. And by March 23rd, in the evening, he was ready to go home. And I walked, I was on my way down to his room. We lived on the fourth floor of the hospital, and the men's surgical ward at that time was on the second floor. And on my way down the stairs, his room exploded. The Israelis fired probably a drone-fired missile into his room because they wanted to kill the other fellow in the room, a 56-year-old man who was also wounded and in the hospital receiving treatment, named Ismail Barhum. They were distant cousins from what I understand. So the family or the nurses had put them in the same room to make family visits easier and things like that. Well, you know, that's That's a pretty shocking crime for a few reasons. Firstly, the Israelis said that Ismail, the target of the attack, was Hamas's prime minister in Gaza. Well, okay, nobody thinks you can blow up a hospital to kill Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. That's just completely insane. Nobody would ever make such a claim. And of course, if Hamas did that, probably all of Gaza would be nuked. So there's no situation where you can treat people this way. Furthermore, it's completely illegal under international law. Wounded combatants who are receiving treatment at a hospital are not targets of attacks. In fact, they're a specifically protected class of people under international law. And the Geneva Conventions, I think it's Article 19 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, if I'm remembering correctly, specifically state that the presence of wounded combatants or their sidearms is not considered an act harmful to the enemy as long in a hospital if they're receiving treatment there. So even if you thought that this man was a combatant, which again is ridiculous, even if somebody were to claim that, it's just completely outrageous to think that he can be attacked while in a hospital. So that's, you know, there's two war crimes right there. Next, the firing of explosive weapons into a surgical ward packed to the brim with people, just, you know, the mass casualty of March 18th alone, we saw 221 patients. This just packed to the brim with sick and wounded patients, with healthcare staff, and with a 16-year-old wounded boy in the same room. That's just, there's no scenario where that satisfies the requirement of international law to make all feasible precautions, not to destroy the hospital, not to kill healthcare workers, not to hurt patients, etc. So that's also a war crime. And then thirdly, just such reckless firing into a hospital that you almost kill an international healthcare worker like me. I was 2 minutes away from the room. This is just all outrageous behavior. And it's not something that we should be supporting.
You talk about the Iranian bombing of Beersheba in Israel and the horror people felt. And you say one war crime never justifies another, but Israeli leaders and their American supporters cannot feign outrage over Iranian war crimes when their own forces disregard the law with such impunity and constantly dissemble and obscure the truth while carrying out one of the most direct and systematic attacks on healthcare system in recent memory. Can you talk about your conclusions from this and then the significance of this conversation today as Netanyahu meets with Trump? There's discussion of a possible 60-day ceasefire as Hamas and Israeli officials are meeting in Doha to supposedly hammer out a ceasefire.
Yeah, it's important for people to realize the attack on March 23rd and the lies told to justify it, the mangling of international law told to justify it, none of that is unique. We give several examples in the piece if anyone wants to read it, but literally every attack on a healthcare facility in Gaza has been justified by it's just either a total misunderstanding, a willful misunderstanding of international law, or just outright lies. And, you know, there have been some pretty extreme examples. Like, for one thing we didn't talk about in the piece was something else that happened on March 23rd, the same day Ibrahim was killed in his room. That's the day that the 15 paramedics, civil defense workers, and the UN worker were killed in Tel el-Sultan near Rafah. The Israelis initially said that they fired on Hamas, approaching them in an ambulance. Well, when they dug up the mass grave of those 15 paramedics a few days later, they found one of their cell phones, and they found that absolutely nothing of the sort had happened. The guy had, I think his name was Rafat, he had videotaped the entire thing, and literally everything the Israelis had said was a lie. Well, okay, fine. Now the Israelis said, well, we have to investigate to appease people. The New York Times is saying, oh, maybe we lied about something. So they wrote up an investigation, which the Israeli media reported didn't even take account of the findings that the investigative team found when they did a recreation of the scenario in the West Bank. They found that what the commander had said was complete lies. They found that the commander literally endangered his own troops just to go and destroy these ambulances for no reason. None of this was in the report. And furthermore, the complete misunderstanding of international law that you don't just get to attack ambulances because you think they might possibly pose a threat to you, this is completely outrageous. So this is a widespread problem. It's not just, you know, one example. And what it means for these ceasefire negotiations, it's difficult to say, but The problem with the ceasefire is that under no circumstances are Israel or the United States going to take under no circumstances are they going to lift the blockade of Gaza. And the blockade of Gaza is exactly what led to October 7th. If we're just going to put the Gazans back into a concentration camp and let them continue to languish and die there, that's not a ceasefire. That's just, you can call it a piece of the graveyard if you like, but it's certainly not a step towards peace. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the Trump administration has a miraculous turnaround, but I don't see that happening, unfortunately, unless Americans put pressure on it.
And what do you want to see happen right now, Feroz? You have Netanyahu coming for a series of days. He's meeting with President Trump today. He's meeting with Vance and Republican leaders tomorrow. He's meeting with Marco Rubio. What do you want to see come out of this meeting and what's happening in Doha, the Hamas-Israeli negotiators?
Well, just like under the Biden administration, I'd like the United States to be a country where the law matters. Benjamin Netanyahu is an accused war criminal, so should Donald Trump, so was Joe Biden. But the United States should be a place where we apply our laws to ourselves. That's the whole purpose of the law. It's completely illegal to continue to arm chronic and obstinate human rights abusers like Israel. And we should stop doing that. I don't expect the Trump administration will all of a sudden think that the law matters, given its behavior. Administration also never came to this reasonable conclusion. But the American people don't have to accept that we live in a lawless country where the government can just do whatever it wants. That's not the case. We have the power to act.
If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Hello, this is Jack Layton, and you're listening to CFRC. Think critically.
And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm singing.